Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started. So I call to order the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you very much for being here. As we are celebrating Valentine's Day, for those who are not history buffs, today is also the birthday of our great state. So thank you for being here. What we're going to do is have our public hearings first. And we had a request for two different groups wanting to go first. And the power of the chair, the executive decision is, we'll start off with Senate Bill 34. And then we're going to go to Senate Bill 7011 and then finish up with Senate Bill 76. So with that in mind, I'm going to go ahead and open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 34. And Whitney, if you can give us an overview.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 34 was brought to us by the Department of Transportation. It expands what is known as the move-over law to include all motor vehicles that are stopped and displaying warning or hazard lights, or has a person that is indicating distress by using flares or emergency signs. This would be a Class B traffic violation. There are no amendments. There is no fiscal impact, and there is a minimal revenue impact.
All right, and for those who are so lucky to get to go first, there are five individuals that signed up, and I understand they're going to be very quick and moving through, because that's why they got to go first. All right, so with that, I have five individuals. I'm not sure how the panels want to go. Everyone is on support, so Craig, I see that you're here for AAA, and Paul, you're here with ODOT. So do we want to have you two first come up? And Craig, I don't know if you had anyone coming up with you or not. Okay. Besides the other three, which is Bob Russell, and I think it's Werner Seaman, and then Lee Erickson. Is there anyone else who will want to testify on Senate Bill 34? And your name, sir? All right, Greg, we'll have you come up in the next panel. And with that in mind, if I could have Lee come on up now, then we'll have a panel of three. And Paul, do you want to lead us off on this, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT here, testifying in favor of Senate Bill 34. This bill is about safety for highway workers and just motorists alongside the road changing a flat tire. Today's law only applies to emergency vehicles. It requires you to slow down or move over if you can. Senate Bill 34 would include this slow down or move over to any vehicle with flashing lights, including personal vehicles with their hazards on. Highway workers are at risk every day, even when signs and cones are in place. In fact, one of the most risky things they do is setting up those signs and cones before the work zone is established, or taking those signs and cones down. Attached to my testimony, you'll see some photographs of some of the things that have happened just during the last year or year and a half, where we've had highway workers alongside the road setting up traffic control, doing their work, parked well off the shoulder. In both instances, they were struck by vehicles that went onto the shoulder. You're going to hear some more testimony from some of our workers on that case. But fortunately, in both those cases, in the pictures you see there, our workers were fine. But in one case, the vehicle actually rear-ended one of our vehicles with the worker between the vehicles when the vehicle crashed. Fortunately, he was able to jump up and missed the collision with his legs and end up hitting into the windshield of the oncoming vehicle. In summary, Senate Bill 34 changes Oregon law to protect motorists who are stopped alongside of the highway. ODOT supports passage of this bill as it provides extra measures of security to those who must stop on high-speed highways.
All right, thank you. Who would like to go next?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of AAA in support of Senate Bill 34. I'll be very brief. Those of my members who have to pull over to the side of the road to take care of their cars, have tow trucks come over, take care of them, whatever it is, this is just a good next step for the move-over law. Unfortunately, when we're driving, we tend to have a bad habit of veering toward what we're looking at. Giving us an extra lane when there's somebody on the side of the road just makes the roads that much safer for those who have to pull over. There are good provisions here in here making sure that this doesn't apply to those roads that have just been abandoned on the side of the road, but does take care of those who would otherwise be at risk. Thanks very much.
All right, thank you. And Lee?
Welcome. Thank you for listening to me. I'm an incident responder. I'm also an SIU member.
And Lee, I need for you ODOT. Put, Lee, I need to put your full name on the record, please.
Lee Erickson, L.E. Lee Erickson. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm an incident responder. I'm also an SIU member. I go to thousands of motor vehicle accidents. I've been to approximately 7,500 in the last 14 years. I'm a highway worker. I'm out here dealing with the firsthand of these incidents, and this bill is actually a step to make us safer out on the highway. As Paul mentioned, we've had several incidents across the state. Just this year alone, in our winter, we've had five of our plows hit by distracted drivers throughout the state. Last week, I was hit. My vehicle was hit. I was doing my job. One of my coworkers was hit, spent a day in the hospital. Okay, I support this bill because it'll help not only our highway workers, but our motorists as well.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel?
Maybe I can speak.
Yes, you may. Senator Thatcher.
I also work on the side of the road very often in my business. Excuse me. And I've always felt that, well, just as a motorist, going down the freeway specifically, maybe not so much highways and, you know, arterial roads, but freeways specifically seem like they get congested easily from this. And not only that, congestion can also set up accidents and conflicts. And when you have these kind of random pop-up lane closures, that's kind of what they are, where people don't see necessarily even the bright red and blue flashing lights because they're behind a truck, and suddenly there's people moving over or slowing down. It just seems like there's a lot of conflicts being set up. I see it all the time, near misses all the time, just driving down the freeway when there's congestion and people are having to pull over. And you know, when you're setting up a lane closure on a freeway, you give people a warning about a mile ahead of it, and you're putting signs on both sides of the road. Hey, this is going to be happening. This is going to be happening. This is going to be happening. Here it is. Here's, you know, you're going to be moving over right here, and then you give people a long chance to move over. We don't get that luxury with even the flashing lights. But when we have people just pulled off the side of the road, they're really going to be hard to see. And I think we're going to be setting people up to fail, so to speak, and get tickets that may not be deserved. I remember I've heard of people getting pulled over when the move over law was first put in place, and the police didn't even know that the option was to slow down also if you couldn't move over. Okay. So this person slowed down, but they were told that no, you were supposed to move over. So there's even confusion among law enforcement, and I just feel like if you're going to do this, at least limit it to those with the bright flashing lights, maybe the amber lights, you know, in addition, but not, or people with flares out or something, but people with just their flashing lights on their car, that's going to be hard to see sometimes. And I think we create hazards when we're like suddenly causing people to make quick decisions and we're setting up conflicts and slowdowns that also create conflicts because there's a differential in speed that can be hazardous. And maybe that's not a question, but you know, what do you say to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher, it's dangerous out on our roads. And anytime you're on the side of the road changing a flat tire, you're in a dangerous situation. What we're trying to do with this bill is not create more hazard, but create awareness for that situation and give motorists options of either moving over or slowing down. It's called the move over law, but there, as you pointed out, slowing down is also part of the provision of the law. Bringing attention to the issue, as we have more and more distracted drivers and more collisions that we're experiencing with our crews that we see out there on the road, expanding this law from just emergency vehicles to also include motorists, highway workers, and others alongside the road with those flashing lights. I agree, setting up a work zone is the ideal situation, but in a lot of situations, that's not practical. When we have our emergency responders out there responding to an emergency in the road, or even when we do set up work zone, there is a point you've got to set that first sign out, setting that first cone out. You're going to be exposed in those situations, even if you're setting up the ideal work zone situation. So we think this is a step in the right direction, bringing awareness to that, to the dangers alongside the road.
Thank you. I agree with the education. Yeah. People need to know, but I think a distracted driver is still a distracted driver. Mm-hmm. and I don't know that this will help.
So, Paul, I want to just set the record, I guess, a little bit. So I'm going to ask a couple of questions just to try to get some stuff on the record. My understanding, the way the bill is currently set up, that if you have a multiple lane, same direction, the rule is you should be moving over. But if you can't move over because the lane that you would be moving into has an obstacle, meaning another vehicle, mm-hmm. then you have a duty to slow down. And I believe the bill calls for like 5 miles less than what the designated speed is. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. And then the other thing is that we do understand on a two-lane road, you have no obligation to move into the oncoming lane. Now, I do believe from reading the vehicle motor code that you can, in fact, under law, move over the double yellow line if there is an obstacle in the road or something that's hindering your ability to be safe in passing. So I'm wondering if this would be interpreted that someone would have to do that if they had that option, or based on my reading of the bill, it seems like in a single lane, one direction, meaning a two-lane road, that all they would have to do is slow down below 5 miles an hour from the designated speed.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The expectation would be just in that situation, a two-lane situation, one lane each direction, you would just have to be required to slow down by 5 miles an hour in that situation.
Okay. And the last part I don't remember in the bill is what Senator Thatcher brought up. Is this activated when just you see a car on the side of the road to take these cautions? Or do they actually have to have some type of a concerted effort in the sense of their hazard lights on, emergency lights on, for this law to apply, understanding that if we're having a provision that if it's just, quote, unquote, an abandoned car without someone there, right. Could you give us clarification on that?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's the provision. The bill has the flashing lights, so if you're in your personal vehicle, you need to have your flashing hazards on for this to apply. If it's an abandoned vehicle or you're just parked on the side of the road without those lights on, then the law does not apply. So there has to be flashing lights, either personal vehicle, your hazards, or in our vehicles, the overhead lights that we have on our vehicles.
Okay. With those questions asked, other questions? Senator Luscombe.
With regard to the questions that Senator Prezansky just asked, in your statistics, in the number of accidents, in the tow trucks or snowplows that were hit, the pictures that you have, how many of those took place on a two-lane highway? How many of those took place on a multiple-lane highway, et cetera, to give us a feel for that? And it seems to me, with regard to the flashing lights on or off as hazard lights, all of us as good drivers, seeing a car pull off to the right-hand shoulder ought to be slowing down and paying attention and, quote, non-distracted drivers.
Right.
It seems like a fine line to comb before this individual got his flashers on, his rig was hit, but I'm not guilty, and all of those kinds of things. It seems like we're creating a mess of fine-tooth combing to figure out what's what and why's why. But I'm interested in the statistics.
Mr. Chair, Senator Luscombe, I don't have a statistic in front of me. I can tell you the two examples we have in the photographs there. They're one of each. One of the incidences is on a two-lane roadway. The other is on the Sunset Highway, a four-lane divided highway. We see experiences in all those situations where we have on our divided freeway-style highways as well as our two-lane rural roadways. We have the same exposures and same concerns and same incidences as depicted in those pictures.
Last question. Do you think this this legislation will stop the distracted driver problem?
Mr. Chair, Senator Luscombe, no. There's a lot more work we need to do. This is just one step in that direction to bring, if nothing, attention to the issue and awareness to the issue and clear expectations to drivers of what most of us think is common courtesy. Just make it clear to drivers what those expectations are.
Thank you.
Senator Manning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the bill, maybe you can help me understand. I'm looking at the bill as not as much as for the individual personal private owned vehicle, POV, but in terms of emergency workers, tow truck drivers or ambulance or any that are non-law enforcement that's out there to render aid or to assist the driver. So this is what I thought the bill was about, but I'm, it sounds more like it even expands towards a private-owned vehicle that is pulled over to the shoulder. So can you help me?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Manning, the current law applies to emergency vehicles, and so you define that by ambulance, fire, law enforcement. We have our incident response vehicles out there. It's a little gray area whether they're actually emergency vehicles or not. This just makes that clear that our vehicles out there are fit within the law, and then expands it also to personal vehicles for those also out there having to deal with an emergency in their personal vehicle.
Okay, so for the individual that, say, I'm driving down the road and I have a flat tire blowout or something like that, I put on my hazards flashing lights, then that would apply according to this bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Manning, yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right, any other questions? Paul, I do want to follow up a couple more points. I think Senator Thatcher brought up a very good point. It was kind of in the back of my mind regarding education outreach. What, if any, PSA approach are you going to see the ODOT trying to do to make people more aware of what it's a current law, let alone what's going to be the new addition if it goes forward?
Mr. Chair, we have signs out there now that will reflect this, will adjust to reflect this law if it's adopted. We also have PSAs that go out regularly with our safety messages. We have a lot of work we're doing on distracted drivers, and this will be included in our overall message around safety, distracted drivers, and just awareness of emergency vehicles and hazards on the side of the road.
All right. And I think the last thing, again, to set the record, knowing that this does come into play when you have some type of visual or audio signal that someone, you have a driver that's on the problem. If you have the emergency flashers on a vehicle going, you shouldn't be just thinking, well, is there actually someone there with the car or not?
Right.
That should be your key to slow down, and don't think, well, it looks like it's an abandoned car even though the lights are on. It would seem to me that for those who are thinking, does this apply or not, that they should be operating under the scenario that there is someone close to the car,
right,
and taking the actions that's required?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. In the current law, it says emergency vehicles, and so as you approach a flashing light, you have to make the determination, is that an emergency vehicle or not? This makes it clear. If you see a flashing light, you need to follow the move over or slow down protocol.
All right. Any other comments on for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and ask our last panel to come forward. And I believe, again, it's Varner, if I can read my the writing here, not my writing. Bob Russell and then Greg. Yeah. And Greg, your last name again, sir?
Honeyman.
Thank you. And gentlemen, I'm not sure who would like to go first.
I'm Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I'm here in support of the bill. One of the most dangerous things that truck drivers are asked to do is to put chains on their vehicles or take them off. They always have their hazard lights on when they do that. But the reason it's so dangerous is they have their back to the traffic, and they can't see the traffic coming. So this law is very positive from our perspective, and we support it a great deal. I also share Senator Thatcher's concern about the confusion with the law, and ODOT has agreed that they will also emphasize that it's not just move over, it's also slow down, which I think is really important, particularly on multi-lane roads. Matter of fact, you may have heard Mr. Mather say that this is the slow down or move over law instead of the other way around. So they're going to emphasize that slowing down complies with the law as well as moving over. And that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman with Portland General Electric, and I apologize for my penmanship.
It's just how it fades through. Yeah. So we need to have maybe ask Christy to make sure we have big, hard tip pens where the chair can actually read the transcript here.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Pozanski. Chair Pozanski. I'm here today in speak in support of Senate Bill 34. We have a standing effort at Portland General Electric to work on safety and to try to be continuously looking to improve the safety of our line workers who are out in the field. What we have seen, especially we're coming off of a pretty intense storm season, which we hope is over, but we've had a lot of crews out setting up work sites by the side of the road. One of the things that our crews have come forward with is an increased concern about their own personal safety when they're doing the work to respond to outages and do planned work by the side of the road. If we had not seen this bill come forward, we were intending to try to come forward with our own bill this year to make sure that utility workers are included in the slowdown and move over provisions, which without the passage of this bill, our crews would not be in that list of folks that you need to slow down and move over for. We see this as a pretty serious safety concern for our folks, like all the other people that you're hearing who are out next to the side of the road, and so we're very much in support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Greg?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Craig Honeyman, League of Oregon Cities. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 34 as well. Most of the conversation this morning talks about freeways and highways and higher speeds, but in cities where there are multiple lanes headed in the same direction, this is no less important of an issue. So the League is in support of this legislation. And the fact that maybe the speeds aren't as great there and there is more congestion, the opportunity to move over or slow down makes us fine with this bill. Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. Thank you. I think just for the a comment, I think for the urban areas, fortunately or unfortunately, because this is how the road design is, most of those roads do not actually have shoulders that you can actually move off. So you are going to actually be blocking a lane, which puts people more directly in the traffic. Questions for anyone on the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Again, I'm going to ask whether or not there's anyone else who'd like to give testimony on SB 34. Not seeing anyone coming forward, we'll close the public hearing. We do have all of the paperwork, Whitney.
Yes, that's correct.
So unless we need more time to consider, I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session. I am opening up a work session on Senate Bill 34. And
Mr. Chair, do you want me to move it and then vote no?
I'm going to give you your choice. If you'd like to move it, fine. If not, we're going to ask Senator Dimbro.
I can move it.
Okay.
Excuse me. The last couple of individuals referred to this as the slowdown or move over. Items A and B under Section 1.1. Sub A and B are in the wrong order. If it's a slowdown, then or move over in that order, this says you've got to make a lane change, and that's the first thing you read. And point B is you could slow down. And if we're trying to promote people being aware, taking notice of whether there's an individual present or not, or whether there's flashing lights, or it's only a right-hand turn signal as they pull off to the side of the road, and are there cones out and all those things, what we really want to do is raise driver awareness. And to raise driver awareness, this now, all of a sudden, as a driver, we're confusing people. They're thinking it's their obligation to move. So they're checking their mirror. They're looking left. They're looking right. They're deciding how they're going to navigate out of the way, because that's the primary item. Point A, make a lane change. Point B is, or reduce the motor speed, you know, as you're on the highway. I think we would be better off to reverse those and say, slow down, pay attention, get your act together, versus, oops, you got to change lanes, get moving.
Okay, so hold that thought. Senator Thatcher, would you make a motion?
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 34 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 34 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We will incorporate Senator Lithgow's statements into the discussion. That's where we're at now, is discussion. So we now have that as part of our record as the discussion. My response would be, is based on our discussion with ODOT Representative Mr. Mather, the primary is that you do have a duty to move
way out of the lane that you're in. That's the primary purpose of the bill, because it gives the most safety. If you're not able to do that because there, as I put on the record, an obstacle, meaning another vehicle or something that's keeping you from making that lane change, then your duty is to slow down to a minimum of 5 miles an hour, less than what the posted speed is at. So I believe the way the bill is currently written is exactly how the sponsors wanted it. So I'm more than willing to open it up for additional discussions as to whether that is something we would want to entertain. The chair is, I'm going to say, is fine with the construction of the bill as it's written, because it does seem to provide the most safety for all involved individuals, because even slowing down to 5 miles an hour or less and still passing a vehicle that's in distress can in fact still be it is more of a hazard than it would be if the vehicle has moved over into the adjacent lane. Other comments? Senator Manning.
Thank you, Chair. I think that Senator Littlecombe had a great point, but I also think that the way the chair has framed this as the bill is designed, that is the first thing we want to do is, you know, being in the Army, you want to take immediate action. So the first thing you do is that you get out of the line of fire, which would indicate you move over if you're able to do so. The second option would be, of course, is to slow down. So I'm okay with the bill as stated right now, and we'll be in support of the bill.
Senator Denbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You know, first I want to say that, you know, the use of the word or is really a coordinator, right? So these are two items of equal weight. Just the fact that the one comes before the other, I think, doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, the first is more important than the second. That's how I understand the phrasing. And, you know, it's funny, I actually hadn't prepared for this bill, I'm ashamed to say, before today. But it so happened that yesterday as I was driving down, there was someone who was changing a flat tire on the side of the road. And I really remarked at what a dangerous position that person was in, because cars were not moving over. And there really was very little space between that side of the road and where some of the cars were. And so I think this is a really important step forward. Thank you.
All right. Any other discussion?
Oh, I'm just going to say that slowing down to 60 is not a whole lot safer than 65. You know,
I disagree.
If you get hit by that, you're still, you know.
Well, yeah, I can say as a cyclist, even though we have in the law where someone needs to take actions if you're driving over 35 miles an hour, them dropping down to 30 miles an hour, it's still awareness that you have. So if there's no other discussion, I'm going to go ahead and ask if there's any objection to the motion. The motion, again, is the passage of Senate Bill 34 to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Senator Thatcher is in opposition. Is anyone else? Just before we go with that, the motion carries, and the chair will carry Senate Bill 34 to the floor. Go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 34. We're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing, which is Senate Bill 11. Whitney, I believe you're taking the lead on this one, too.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 11.
It's contagious.
No. Senate Bill 11 increases the annual salary for Oregon judges and also establishes rate increases of those salaries through January 1st, 2020. There is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. There is no revenue impact, and there are no amendments.
All right, thank you. I have two individuals that are listed to give testimony, Chief Justice Tom Ballmer and Judge Janet Starver. Oh, it's Janet.
Janet Starver.
I was trying to make that an M for some reason. I apologize.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Ballmer. I'm the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court.
And with me today is Judge Janet Stauffer, a circuit court judge. Circuit court, and she lives up to the name out there. She, the 7th Judicial District, covers Hood River, Wasco, Sherman, Gillum, and Wheeler counties. And Judge Stauffer is here in her role as president of the Oregon Circuit Court Judges Association. And with the chair's permission, I'll make a few remarks. Then Judge Stauffer will give the perspective of herself and the Circuit Court Judges Association, and then I'll close with just a minute, if that's all right with the chair. And I would thank you for holding this hearing. It's always great to be here on Valentine's Day, on the state's birthday. And I always feel a little surge of state patriotism on February 14th. This is an important topic for all three branches of government. And for anyone who cares about the quality of justice in Oregon. And that's why this issue is my priority if there are options to add to the Judicial Department budget this session. And I'd like to thank the committee members who've signed the letter in support of SB 11, 22 senators and 40 representatives from both parties and from all across the state have signed the letter as of yesterday. So I very much appreciate the broad bipartisan support for this effort. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this problem, Oregon's problem with judicial compensation has really been decades in the making, and we have made important and meaningful progress in the last few years, and I want to particularly thank you and other members who have supported this effort over the past 4 years, where we really have made some progress. It's critical that we continue to make progress towards getting our salaries to the median of the 13 Western states, and that's what we're trying to do in this bill. Our bench is getting older. We need to keep on the bench some of the very good judges and experienced judges that we have now. We need to be able to attract and retain new judges, and that's why we're here asking the legislature to finish the job that you started about 4 years ago. By any measure, Oregon state judges are underpaid. Compared to judges in other states, with information that was provided as of January 1 for the National Center for State Courts, even with the increases, we are still in the bottom tier nationwide. We have moved up from about 50th to 48th when cost of living is considered. Our Court of Appeals judges are actually 33rd in the country, but there are only 40 states that have intermediate courts of appeals. But we have moved up some. Still, we are getting less than the median of the 13 Western states, which was the benchmark that the Public Officials Compensation Commission, which was the last independent group to look at this, set at 2008. And I think many of the members who've been working on this issue with us for the last few years understand that has been the goal. And this bill would get us there. And with the cost of living increase that was a cost of living adjustment mechanism that was put in legislation in 2015, that should keep us there. And so if we can pass this bill, I won't darken your door again, at least during my career. Our judges are also underpaid when compared to other Oregon lawyers. The average salary in 2011 for Oregon lawyers who responded to the state bar's survey showed that the median as being just under what circuit court judges were making last year. So that's comparing average Oregon lawyer in 2011 with circuit judges last year, pretty close to the same. But that survey also showed that the longer you've been practicing in Oregon and the older you get, the average salary increases. So this is, again, 2011 survey. Lawyers in their 40s were making about $145,000. Lawyers in their 60s were making $167,000. And that is far more than our circuit judges make. Far more than I make, and we need to make sure that we're paying judges so we can attract some of these really good lawyers to come and be judges. Our judges are underpaid compared to other public sector lawyers, especially those that appear before our judges on a regular basis. The Deputy Attorney General, which is a position that I held under Attorney General Kulongoski 20 years ago, he made significantly more than any justice on the Supreme Court, including me. According to the Oregon Transparency website, dozens of state lawyers make more than any circuit judge, including legislative counsel, the chief deputy, about 100 senior assistant attorneys general. Our trial judges also make substantially less, and I make substantially less, than the senior deputy district attorneys in the larger counties. General counsel at the public agencies, like the top city and county attorneys, or the senior judges, senior lawyers at the Oregon State Bar, or law professors at our state's law school. Now, I don't point those salaries out to say that they're inappropriate, only to note that these skilled, experienced attorneys are not where we're likely to find our next generation of judges. The economic sacrifice is simply too great. And I also do it knowing I sound like a whiner, and I don't like to sound like a whiner, but my concern is for the branch as a whole, and how do we keep and then bring in the next really good generation of lawyers. We don't have to pay top private sector salaries. There is a reward in public service that is very important to all of our judges, but we have to be within shouting distance. In 2015, as I mentioned, the legislature approved a cost of living increase, and that really addressed a major problem, I think, for our compensation structure. The previous pattern of granting increases to judges every 5 years or so basically just addressed inflation. It didn't do anything to deal with the systemic problem. But Oregon's bench, which has so many excellent judges, as I mentioned, is aging. We've got a big baby boomer cohort. I received another retirement letter yesterday from one of our experienced judges in Multnomah County. And we need to increase compensation to keep those judges on the bench a little longer. We can't afford to have 40 or 50 or 60 really experienced judges leaving over the next 5 years. And I think that the changes that we've made in the last few years, where, again, we really have made some progress, that has helped us retain some judges who might otherwise have decided to move on and do something different. More importantly, we need to increase compensation to be able to continue recruiting the best lawyers, including those in high demand, litigation, and specialty practices to the bench. We need them to take the bench not just as the final chapter in their career, but to give them time on the bench. We'd like to have judges who've got 10 or 15 or 20 years of experience. This is very difficult work. It's different than what you do as a lawyer, as the chair knows. And we have a set of judges that need to preside over a huge array of cases from civil to criminal to family, and deal with these issues that are presented to them every day in Oregon's circuit courts. With that, Mr. Chair, if I could turn it over to Judge Stauffer, and then I just have 1 minute to close, if that's okay.
That's great. Thank you. Judge Stauffer.
Thank you. Chair Pruszanski and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, for the record, I am Janet Stauffer. I am a circuit court judge in the 7th Judicial District, which does include several areas, Hood River, Wasco, Sherman, Wheeler, and Gillum counties. I also have the privilege of serving as the president of the Circuit Court Judges Association this year. The entire executive committee is here today. I'd like to introduce them if I can. Josephine Mooney here from Lane County. Benjamin Bloom here from Jackson County, Mary James here from Marion County, and Lauren Holland here from Lane County. So as you can see, it's very important to us. Mostly we're here because it's very important to our 170-some members. As you know, I'm here to speak today in favor of House Senate Bill 11. This is the fourth year that I've attended these hearings. I just want to make it clear that though we keep coming back, we're not asking for anything different. We have made some headway. We are still not to the median. We are asking for the same figure that we've been asking for since we started coming to these hearings. I'm really honored and thankful for the opportunity to work here and to represent the association, and I'm very thankful for the work that you guys have done or your previous members have done that helped benefit our circuit court judges in the last few years. We're here to ask you today to finish the job. Unfortunately, this time we come to you in a very different fiscal environment, and I want to acknowledge that. I'm sure all of you are hearing from your constituents on a daily basis about the need for their basic concerns, their basic needs. These are the folks that we serve every day. I know you're aware of the work that we do. Our days are filled to the brim with making decisions that impact families, children, businesses, agriculture, landlords and tenants, victims, and addressing the rights of those who are charged with crimes. Judges, especially at the trial court level and actually on every level, must be knowledgeable in all aspects of the law. The judicial branch plays a very important role also in the checks and balances of government. Judges are often the lowest paid lawyer in the courtroom. As the chief mentioned, not only do most private hire attorneys earn significantly more than the judges, over 100 lawyers in the Attorney General's office and many of the district attorneys also earn more than the judges to whom they plead their cases. We are not here with a new request. We ask only that you set judicial salaries at the median of the Western states. Over 60 of your members have signed a letter in support of that plea. I hope it's part of this record today. In addition, we've been carrying around these yellow sheets for the last few years also. It's pretty much the same. It's the same number. It's the same request. We're getting closer. I'd be happy to say that I won't come back either during my career if we can hit that number, because thank goodness for the COLA that you guys impose, that once we get to that figure, we really are at the median, and it wouldn't be right for us to come back and ask for more. We need this number in order to be able to recruit and keep the judges that we have. A couple of judges from my district, we're a four-judge district, five counties, have left recently. They both went to private practice. Well, one went to private practice, one went to private mediation service. I suspect that they are more well off because of the change.
Financially.
One in particular is still very helpful with the court coming back to do judicial settlement conferences. I thank you for your prior support and ask that you please finish this job by implementing the fiscally prudent bill. We've tried to spread it over a time frame where it won't have a significant impact. It is, compared to the budgets that you guys are trying to balance at this point, is a pretty minor number. But over time, it would ensure that we can recruit and retain judges that do the difficult job. So I urge you to pass this bill on. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? I'd just like to make one statement. This is, I'd want to thank everyone. I believe it's part of the officers for the association, meaning all of the circuit court judges that did make it up here today. Normally, we have an opportunity to see a lot of people in the third branch of government, the executive branch. Rarely do we have the opportunity and the honor to have the judicial branch here in any numbers. So thank you very much for coming from your districts. We really appreciate it. Let me ask if there's anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 11. Not seeing anyone. Again, thank you all very much. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill number 11. And if we are ready to move the bill, this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. In other words, we will not be sending it to the floor. This will only go down to the Ways and Means process of them determining what, if any, financial means they have to honor the request in the bill. So with that, Senator Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 11 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 11 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral that's been requested by the President's office to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion on the motion? Senator Denborough.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that this bill will not reattach our salaries to their salaries. Is that correct?
Senator Denborough, thank you for clarifying and setting the record. You are correct. I will not make a commentary as to that position, but you are correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nevertheless, I do support this.
All right. Any other questions or comments? Not seeing any. Does anyone have any objection to the motion? Senator Lithicum.
I think the flaw in this discussion is the median isn't a magic potion, and I think that from any group of individuals of less than 200, the claim will be that it's a minor dollar figure. And because it's a minor dollar figure, it's okay. The governor's budget has a 6% salary increase. And everybody's up in arms in my constituent district with regard to the amount of money that we're bending here in Salem. This isn't a large number, but at some point we're going to need the wherewithal to slow it down, to stop, to make objections. Ways and Means is going to have this all collide on their head. And at some point, it's unfair to keep saying, well, we don't have to deal with it. Ways and Means will check it out. The sharpest and best lawyers are already in the bar. And to make the claim that we're not getting those best of the best, I think, is disingenuous. The best of the best are there, that men and women make choices and move in and out of those positions for a various sundry reasons is a normal pattern in the life of an attorney. So I have objections. I think the COLA increase from a while back addresses the major problem, and just trying to strive for that median doesn't solve our problem, but heaps more trouble on the Ways and Means Committee.
All right. So I take that as an objection.
Thank you for letting me speak.
No, that's fine. I just was at the point where we're voting, so I just want to make sure that we docket your vote, and you're saying no to the motion. Okay. Any other no's to be acknowledged? Not seeing any. The motion carries, and the bill is going to the President's office for subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 11. And again, thank you for the judicial branch for having representation here today. And your battle now is where you've been before. Some people call it down in the basement. It's where the mole people are. We wish you luck. All right. With that, we're going to go ahead and open up the last of our public hearings, which is on Senate Bill 76. And Michael or is doing this one? Or Whitney?
Me.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 76 was brought to us by the Oregon State Police. Located within the Oregon State Police is the Oregon State Athletic Commission. The commission currently regulates boxing, mixed martial arts, and entertainment wrestling. Senate Bill 76 changes several of the current regulatory laws and its financing. There is no fiscal impact. There are no amendments. The revenue impact is indeterminate, as it is possible that Senate Bill 76 will result in larger and more frequent unarmed combat sport events in Oregon, and Senate Bill 76 defines unarmed combat sport events.
All right. So I have two individuals that are signed up, Terry Davey and Bob Carperman?
Sharpentier, sir.
Okay, Sharpentier. All right. Please come forward. While they're coming up, is there going to be anyone else who would like to give testimony today on Senate Bill 76? Not seeing anyone. Terry, are you going to start off? Or?
I will, Chair.
Okay.
Chair Brzozinski, Vice Chair Thatcher, and members of the committee, I am Terry Davey. I am the Deputy Superintendent of the Oregon State Police. With me today is Lieutenant Bob Sharpentier, and I would like to speak with testimony in support of Senate Bill 76. If Senate Bill 76 is passed, it will make additions and modifications to ORS 463, and 463 is the statute, the chapter that regulates our Oregon State Athletic Commission and the sports that we regulate. So the way we have it structured within our Oregon State Police is kind of a hybrid at the moment. In 2014, we realized that we need to invest a few more resources into the commission because we found out there were some issues on how we are regulating different sports, and also we needed to ensure the safety of our competitors. I was brought into the commission roughly in June of 2014. Historically, our budget has been under our gaming enforcement section, and we left it there because we do not know where this will fall within our structure once we are done with our review and our restructure of the commission. The purpose of the Oregon State Athletic Commission is to protect the health, the safety, and the best interest of the competitors and the participants that participate in the sports regulated by the Oregon State Athletic Commission. A little history to let you know about the commission and how it has evolved to where it is today. In 1988, the legislature created the Boxing and Wrestling Commission with a primary focus of professional boxing and wrestling in the state of Oregon. In 1999, it was brought under the umbrella of the Oregon State Police, and we assumed the program and the regulatory responsibilities of professional boxing and wrestling. As time passed on, it morphed more from the wrestling field into an entertainment wrestling. And also on the horizon was what was now called mixed martial arts. A lot of events were occurring in Oregon that were unregulated events throughout, which were more of a hybrid of all the different styles of fighting, commonly referred to as ultimate championship fighting, no holds bar. Quite a variety of different titles were given to the different events happening in Oregon. In 2007, the Oregon State Police, specifically the Boxing and Wrestling Commission, determined that to ensure the competitors were being taken care of and their safety was being monitored, that the Oregon State Police, on behalf of the Boxing and Wrestling Commission, would start and prepare a bill in hopes of regulating the sport. And that sport was ultimately termed mixed martial arts, or MMA for short. And also the bill that was passed in 2007 changed the name of the Boxing and Wrestling Commission to the Oregon State Athletic Commission. And it also brought mixed martial arts under the regulatory authority of the commission, and at that same time changed our regulatory authority of entertainment wrestling to entertainment wrestling. It was wrestling, but as some may remember, in the 80s we had what was commonly referred to as the entertainment wrestling sport, especially in the Portland area. And this brings us to where we are today, is the commission regulates boxing, mixed martial arts, and entertainment wrestling in Oregon. Back in 2007, I do want to note that there was also a funding package that went with it to try to increase the staffing of the commission. We were granted authority to use our general funds from the state police in order to fund the commission, and that is what we have been doing since then. Our structure for the Oregon State Athletic Commission, it originally was one FTE position, and it was titled an executive director. As times have changed throughout the state government, the executive director title is more of a state agency head, and this is a program within our department. We went through a restructure and classification last year and determined it is actually a event administrator position. So we have an administrator position that runs our commission. We have a governmental auditor. We have a compliance specialist and an OS2, our office specialist. Currently, three of those four positions are filled. Two of the positions are a limited duration, and the one is the full-time equivalent position that we have. We have a governing board. The commission board is comprised of five volunteer members who help us oversee the commission and give us guidance. And also part of our structure is called the Medical Advisory Committee, where our physicians and give us guidance and best practices in the medical field in order to ensure the safety and health of our competitors. For the next portion, if there's no questions, I'm going to defer to Lieutenant Charpentier, and he will go into our regulatory and the proposed Senate bill.
Okay, I think why don't we do this? I'm going to go ahead and let the lieutenant testify, and then I'd like to open up for the panel, unless you need to ask a question now. Lieutenant, why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony, then we'll just do all the questions at the same time.
Thank you, Chair Przonski, Vice Chair Thatcher, and members of the committee. Thank you for the time this morning. OSAC's current regulatory responsibilities include professional boxing, professional kickboxing, amateur boxing, amateur kickboxing, professional mixed martial arts, amateur mixed martial arts, and entertainment wrestling.
Lieutenant, I apologize. I need you to put your full name on the record.
Sorry, Lieutenant Bob Charpentier.
Thank you.
There, and going back to amateur boxing and amateur kickboxing, through our statute review, we learned in 2015 that there were portions of amateur boxing that we were responsible for. For many years, we have deferred that regulation to USA Boxing, which is an amateur athletic organization, a nonprofit one, to add. But there's portions of that we're responsible for, and we'll go over that further in future slides. One of our other regulatory responsibilities is researching and investigating illegal smoker events. Now, we are responsible for the entire state, and those illegal events are events that should be regulated by OSAC. However, promoters or companies or individuals want to hold an event with no regulation, and that's our responsibility to look for those and find those to protect the health and safety of the competitors. Some of the challenges that we have faced with Chapter 463 and ORS are contradictions throughout the chapter. And as I said before, during this biennium, we conducted a detailed review of Chapter 463. Two of the concerns were identified that required legislative change, and those concerns are procedures utilizing officials and who was going to pay those officials and how to make sure that they were that we were being paid appropriately for their duties at events were not in alignment with statute. So it was determined in June of 2014 that the Department of State Police, the superintendent to be specific, is responsible for the payment of officials. However, prior to that, it was the responsibility of the promoters to pay officials to regulate an event. Additionally, on a historical level, OSAC regulated professional boxing only, but through this review, like I previously stated, OSAC has some responsibility to regulate amateur boxing. That more specifically is the licensing of promoters and collecting a 6% gross receipts tax. However, the safety portion of that is we don't have the authority to license amateur boxers or, more importantly, blood test amateur boxers, and that would be a hepatitis B, hepatitis C, an HIV test to make sure it's safe for people to compete. So the statute does not allow us to do that with amateur boxing. In mid-November of 2015, we met with members of the Muay Thai community that have been trying for years to hold events in Oregon. And Muay Thai is becoming more and more popular in Washington and California. And the desire to promote Muay Thai events in Oregon is starting to reach a higher level. So we had a meeting, and through that meeting, we discussed what our regulatory authority was. And if you're not familiar with Muay Thai, it's a martial art with 8 points of contact. So it's, you know, elbow strikes, kicks to the face. It's a very dangerous sport. And through this change, we hope to regulate that. Senate Bill 76, some of the highlights related to this include, we want to clarify the promoter's responsibility related to compensation of officials, medical personnel, and medical supplies utilized. Additionally, we want to introduce and define the term unarmed combat sport. We want to clarify OSAC's regulatory responsibilities towards professional and amateur boxing, professional and amateur kickboxing, professional and amateur mixed martial arts, and add regulatory responsibilities related to professional and amateur Muay Thai. This Senate Bill 76 also adds regulatory responsibilities of any other professional or amateur unarmed combat sport that may fit the definition in the future. So this change really sets us up to provide safety for competitors for future sports that we deem fall under the definition of unarmed combat sports, which I'll go over here in just a second. Senate Bill 76 also authorizes OSAC to defer regulatory authority of some amateur unarmed combat sports events, which again I'll go over here shortly. As you can see, we have the definition up here for unarmed combat sports, and what that simply means is any form of competition where the intent is to win by striking, knockout, technical knockout, or by inflicting damage by submission and striking. It's important for us to clarify what is not unarmed combat sports, and that includes any martial arts exhibited independently of one another, like taekwondo, karate, kenpo karate, judo, sumo, jiu-jitsu, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, submission wrestling, kung fu, and any other unarmed combat sport or martial art where the intent is for the competitor to win by points. One of the sports that's becoming really popular in Oregon is submission grappling. And that is something that's not OSAC's responsibility, should not be OSAC's responsibility, but it is gaining popularity. So this definition really hones in on what should be our responsibility today and making it very clear for future. And now we move on to the definition of amateur athletic organization. And this means an organization that's organized and operated exclusively to foster state, national, and international amateur unarmed combat sports competition. A good example of this is USA Boxing. If you're familiar with USA Boxing, it's been around forever, and they're there to really foster the sport for amateur athletes. amateur athletic organization. What this does for OSAC is it allows us to defer regulation of amateur unarmed combat sports to an approved amateur athletic organization. And this would include the following sports: amateur boxing, which we would use or could be used, USA Boxing. Amateur kickboxing, for example, that's USKA, which is the United States Kickboxing Alliance. And then amateur Muay Thai, which there's several. Some of them are the WTBA, which is the World Thai Boxing Association, and USICA, which is the folks that we met with back in November of 15, and that's the United Southeast Asian Cultural Association. Moving on with Senate Bill 76, it also reassigns the responsibility of officials' compensation, medical personnel's compensation, and requires promoters to pay for medical supplies utilized at their event. Currently, OSAC is spending on average $2,350 per event to pay officials to regulate an event. That responsibility really should fall on the promoters. It's their event. We assign the officials to the event to make sure there's no collusion and to keep everything fair there. But since June of 2014, this became OSAC's responsibility. So roughly $2,350 on average is what OSAC is spending to pay for officials per event there. And the passage of Senate Bill 76 would lower the costs of OSAC and offset some of these costs. An additional item for Senate Bill 76 is inspectors become licensed officials. And the importance of this is this allows us to do background checks on the inspectors and make sure there's no issues there. And it ensures all officials are processed consistently, because currently we have to go, the inspectors are appointed by the superintendent. The superintendent is very busy. He's working on public safety issues, trooper issues. And for us to go to the superintendent and say, would you please approve this inspector, it's a unnecessary burden for him when really they're an official that should be licensed. So again, Senate Bill 76 really clarifies this and cleans this up to make them the same as a judge, a timekeeper, a referee, which is where they belong. They should be licensed, not appointed. Senate Bill 76 also allows the superintendent to delegate day-to-day responsibilities to an authorized representative of the Oregon State Athletic Commission. Again, the superintendent's very busy. His responsibility is public safety. Our responsibility is the day-to-day operations of the Athletic Commission. And this includes assigning medical personnel to events, assigning officials, conducting compliance audits, and imposing civil penalties. As we move on, Senate Bill 76 also places a cap on gross receipts at $50,000 per event. You know, and the common question is, well, why would we want a cap on events? We would want to make as much money as possible to make OSAC a functioning unit. The concern with that is the larger promotions, such as the Ultimate Fighting Championship, Bellator, that bring in revenue for the cities and really foster the sport in our state, they stay away from Oregon, and they have stayed away from Oregon because it's too expensive to do business in Oregon. We've had conversations with those folks through conferences, and that's been the common theme is Oregon's too expensive to come and do business in. So by adding this $50,000 cap, it still allows OSAC to work and gain some dollar value or some economic stimulus within the section, but it also attracts these bigger promotions to come to Oregon. And so now with a cap, you may see, you know, for example, last October, the Ultimate Fighting Championship came to Oregon. That allowed OSAC to not lose money at an event. It was an event where we were in the positive, which doesn't happen very often. So this will attract bigger promotions to Oregon. It will improve the sport in Oregon. It improves the communities that the events are being held in through hotels, taxis, restaurants, and things of that nature. Moving on, Senate Bill 76 also allows more time for promoters to pay their gross tax receipts. It's important for OSAC to support small business. Currently, there's a 72-hour time frame for them to get their 6% gross receipts tax to us. That's just not enough time to go through their receipts and get an accurate number. And through conversations with our promoters and our constituents, we felt that giving them a few more days would really allow them to get an accurate number for us, also support them and make them, you know, there's a lot of our promoters that we have other full-time jobs. So this gives them a couple more days to get an accurate tax receipt to us. Here's just a quick idea of what the promoter responsibility is for the average cost of an event. And if you look on the promoter responsibility, six inspectors is common for what we use. It's going to cost a promoter $300 plus mileage, which it depends, you know, at where folks are coming from. It has to be more than 40 miles for them to get compensated for that. Two medical personnel, which is $300 each, or a total of $600. Lodging for officials varies. Some events, there's no lodging required. Some, you know, we may end up needing four or five rooms. And then that average on the 6% gross receipt tax is $1,833. So that bottom number, that total average that the promoters pay to OSAC to regulate an event is $2,733. Now, if you look at the OSAC responsibility column, there are six inspectors. To ensure that we have enough officials to regulate an event, we add additional funds to make it worth their time to come help us regulate this event. So there's additional dollars paid to inspectors for a total of $600. Currently, the way statute's read since June of 2014, officials cost us on average $1,750 to regulate an event. Medical personnel is $1,400, and that includes their hourly salary plus per diem, which is hotels, lodging, food. Medical supplies include suture kits. If a competitor gets a cut on their face, our doctors will stay after and suture the wound to make sure it's closed and fixed right away, rather than sending them to an emergency room where they may sit for 2 or 3 hours. OSAC staff, on average, $2,304. That's for anywhere from 2 to 3 OSAC staff that attend the event to regulate it. It's very important to include in that $2,304 that does not include prep work prior to the event or post-event work. And the prep work prior to an event can be upwards of 40 hours per person. That's licensing, prepping paperwork, background checks, getting documents, you know, looking at parity to make sure it's safe for competitors to compete against each other. So that's just what it just start of an event. So that's a weigh-in, and that's the regulation of an event. Then, so if you go down to that next line, which is the total average spent at an event from OSAC, $6,154. And so if you do a little bit of math there, our per event OSAC average is $3,420 of a net loss. That currently, with the way the statute's written today, that's our average loss per event. So if we look at our biennial cost, OSAC is currently funded by general fund dollars, and our estimated biennial expense is $1,315. $1,315,430. Just a little bit more.
There's an extra comma in there.
Yes, there is. Thank you. If you look at the next line, our revenue for the 15-17 biennium is projected at $263,546. So quite a bit of difference. And out of that $263,000, only $38,000 comes from licensing fees. We have some of the lowest licensing fees in the country. Moving down to the next line, for our 2015-17 biennium, we project a net loss of $1,051,884 through general fund dollars. To close, OSAC is responsible for protecting the health and safety of competitors and participants associated with events that are regulated by the Oregon State Athletic Commission. The passage of Senate Bill 76 would allow OSAC to ensure competitors and participants associated to all unarmed combat sports in Oregon are protected, and promoters that choose to hold events in Oregon are responsible for the compensation to be paid to the medical personnel, the referees, the judges, the timekeepers, and the inspectors that regulate their events. And it just clears up that language and allows us to move forward with a transparent way of doing business. And as you can see, this is our closing picture. This was a large event. This is from a large promoter that we really want to try and attract to Oregon. There's 25 people in this picture, and this really shows you where's two people short in this picture, that this is what it takes to do a good job at an event. And this is, we had no issues at this event. All the competitors were safe, and the promoter was happy with the way we conducted business. It takes a lot of people to regulate these events and make sure that they're done safely and the rules are being followed. Thank you, Chair.
All right, thank you. So first, apologies to everyone here. I should have gone ahead and let you take questions, Ms. Davey. First, knowing that we had a PowerPoint, I should have realized that we could have had questions as we went through. So I apologize to everyone here. Senator Manning, you had some questions to start off with.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Two questions. This presentation is new and very enlightening to me. I had no idea that the State Patrol were the arbiters or the overseers of this type of sports, and I was wondering if this is a model that is that's seen in other states. And the other part is that how much of the manpower, if we are applying troopers for security at these events, is that, does that take? And looking from, you know, the information that's given, it's like we're operating at a loss. And do you think that this is, you know, is this really what law enforcement should be doing?
You may take the first
I'll
part.
Take that. Okay. Chair Posansky, Vice Chair Thatcher, Senator Manning, and members of the committee. To answer, I'll answer part of your questions, and Lieutenant Charpentier will answer the first question. As far as troopers for security, we do not bring troopers in for security. The promoters do provide security personnel that are licensed through Oregon, through our Department of Public Safety and Standards. But as far as troopers that do work with the commission, I was brought on in June of 2014. At the time, I was a lieutenant, and I was brought over to the commission to do the review and to figure out where we go from when there, because we knew there were some issues. And so I reviewed with the team policies, procedures, and practice. So I have been part of the commission since June of 2014. Even though I have promoted since then, I have kept it as a very high duty on my list. I was the captain for the criminal division for the state of Oregon, and I still oversaw the commission. And now I'm the deputy superintendent of the Oregon State Police, and I still am part of the commission. And I will still be going to mixed martial arts events or boxing as needed to participate. It is a very convoluted thing to learn. I have no background in any of these sports, so for me it was from day one a very huge learning curve, and it still is. And for all of our employees that work here, it's a very large learning curve, because you are dealing with the health and safety of individuals, and you have to learn all the regulations, because not only are you worrying about their safety, but also the profession itself, because you're dealing with small business and promoters. And I will let Lieutenant Charpentier answer the first part.
Chair Posansky, members of the committee, Senator Manning, to answer the first part of your question is, in Oregon, we're almost an anomaly. Only Connecticut's the only other state that the commission is regulated by the state police there. So there's only two states in the country that do it this way. So that's the first part of your question. And then just to add a little bit more on troopers involved with OSAC, with the exception of Deputy Davey and myself, who have limited roles with the commission, it is ran primarily by non-sworn members of our department. And at an event, we're dealing with a crowd from anywhere from 300 to upwards of 15,000, depending on the type of event. We rely heavily on private security. That is the responsibility of the promoter to supply for those events. So if you think of a cage or a boxing match, and then there's essentially a 6-foot barrier, we're responsible for the cage and that barrier through the commission. Everything else is the responsibility of the promoter and the security that they hire.
Chair Posansky and members of the committee, I would like to add, it is their responsibility, but we are there to regulate. For instance, we were in a venue over in Bend that was a very closed-in venue, and when we noticed that there was alcohol being served, it was in beer bottles. It's my responsibility to regulate to ensure the safety of participants and competitors and my team, that is one thing that's not allowed in our rules. So we had to stop, make sure they complied with our regulations. So there's all different event items like that. If they do not have adequate security, we will stop the event. Paramedics, if their paramedics are not on scene right next to the apron area, the event is stopped. So we, even though that is our little area of responsibility, there are lots of regulatory functions we have to do in order to make sure the event does go off.
Yeah, and I just want for clarification on that. You really have control over the whole umbrella and through your regulations. Your immediate concern as to what you're doing is within the cage or on the ring and within that barrier. But as you mentioned, if the promoter has failed to provide adequate number of security individuals for the size of crowd, that is something that's going to be regulated. And there's going to either have to have some change or something's going to have to happen, either not as many people coming in, or they're going to have to get other security people there if they can do so, and all that. And that's the part, I think, that's where you have the on-scene necessity for the regulations to ensure that you don't have these conflicts with the rules that cause potential safety for the participants inside the ring, as well as those observing as fans.
Chair Prozanski, you're exactly correct.
All right. Other questions?
Just one quick follow-up. I'm still trying to wrap my arms around this thing that we've got our state patrol that's overseeing mixed martial arts, you know, and professional boxing. It's something I just have to get. I mean, to get adjusted with, because you know, my idea of law enforcement doesn't involve, you know, being part of commercialized sport events, professional full contact. Generally, those are assault batteries that I see law enforcement get involved in.
Let me just take that one instead of y'all needing to respond. This is a decision that we, the legislature, made based on the historical perspective of how the sport or events were not being regulated, and it was a decision that we, the legislature, thought it was best to have this under the state police for multiple reasons. Clearly, if we, the legislature, want to go to a different model, that can be done. That is something that I would say in your position as being on the full Ways and Means. Sometimes there will be things known as budget notes where there are certain tasks are asked to be done, and that might be a way. I would suggest that you might want to either ask the agency or speak with, I'm trying to think who has the historian perspective, but looking at what the intent was. I can't give you all of the details. I believe from what I remember and when this was all coming about, there was a decision that we felt that the state police was in the best position to ensure that their regulations were being followed, that there was not going to be corruption coming into the games and into the field, and we would have a sure hand over the events itself. I can tell you from my memory, when we were looking at even allowing this to happen, there was a lot of concern about, interest that we would not want to be participating in these type of activities within our state. And we just felt that this was the model that was best. So whether we should look at that in the future, that's something we can do. Senator Lethicombe?
A direct response or question with that regard. Lieutenant Charpentier, you described that Oregon's only one of two that has the police in that regulatory capacity. That means there's 48 others that do it differently. What do those look like compared to the way Oregon has and Connecticut, I think, was the other state you referred to?
There, Chair Prozanski, Senator Lethicombe, members of the committee, they're a great question. So Connecticut and Oregon, it's under the state police. And then as you move outward to the other commissions, you see a lot of athletic commissions under the Consumer Licensing Board, or some of them are under the governor's office. California, for one, Washington is under the licensing board. There's different states. That's probably the primary out of all of these, is they're underneath the licensing board within their states, and that's where they're housed.
So just for us, that more than likely would be like the DCBS, which is the agency that does a lot of licensing in private sector area. That wouldn't be the only one, but that's probably what would be most familiar to what we do.
All right. Senator Dimbro, you had questions too, and then Senator Thatcher.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You know, I think that the decision to have the promoters be responsible for the actual costs makes a lot of sense. What sort of process did you go through to have the conversation with them about moving in this direction?
Chair Posansky, Vice Chair Thatcher, and Senator Dimbro, and members of the committee, since I came on board in June of 2014, we have held 13 commission board meetings that are open to the public, and we also, since we knew we were going to do a complete, at the time it was only going to be the administrative rules rewrite is what was my focus. And then I realized with the team that we had some issues within the structure of our ORS 463 that had to be also rewritten. What we did was we immediately contacted all the stakeholders and set up the public meetings with the stakeholders so they could be part of the ORS rewrite and the OAR rewrite. So we have held meetings with them also in conjunction with our board meeting. So we have tried to bring different members of our stakeholders and the public into this process.
And if I could follow up, Ms. Chair.
Yes.
And so is it typical for other states for promoters to be responsible for these actual costs? Does that tend to be the typical way? Is that an expectation that they would have?
Yes, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, Senator Dimbro, members of the committee. Absolutely. We are the only state, through all our research, where we are paying officials' fees. There, we were at a conference earlier in 2016, and these conversations came up, and it was surprised that we were, because prior to June of 2014 in Oregon, it should be noted that it was common practice for the promoters to pay for the officials' fees. So it was just in from June 2014 to current where that changed, and so just to reiterate, yes, we are the only commission in the country where we pay officials' fees.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Thatcher, yes, I apologize.
Well, okay, so you mentioned how some of these promoters, I don't get it, it looks like assault to me, but anyway, some people like it. So they don't want to come here because it's too expensive to do business, and then you showed in 2016 what a promoter paid. And I'm not tracking with what you mean by that. So what is changing? They're going to be paying more of more what?
Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, and members of the committee. Oregon has the 6% gross sales tax, the tax on, but also so does the city, like Portland. Portland also has a 6%. So for instance, a promoter such as the UFC with the title fights, the numbered fights, if they were to come into Oregon, they would pay OSAC's percent plus the city of Portland. And in order to attract them, the goal was to limit the OSAC's 6% tax down to 50,000 cap so they wouldn't be paying even more, because those are very large events. We did hold a UFC fight night, which was different than the numbered fight. And that was on October 1st of 2016. That one brought in to OSAC approximately $30,600. But after you pay all of the fees and all of the official fees and the medical doctors, it was I think it was a little over $9,000 that was to the clear for that event. And that was a very large event. It took a lot of planning. So as far as the promoter pool we have in Oregon right now believes that if we can attract the bigger promoters to Oregon, such as Bellator, UFC, or any other that may be in the future, that will in turn help their business and they will be able to promote more. So I know it doesn't sound like by changing this, we're actually costing the promoters more. And so that 50,000 cap is just a small piece of it. And there is a lot of pushback from the promoters. They do not want to pay. They like the model. They do not think it's their responsibility to pay from the feedback we have received. They would prefer we stay, obviously, with this model where the state of Oregon and the general fund picks up their event fees.
I also had a question about where do the penalties go? If you assess penalties, where does that money go?
Go ahead.
Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, there we have just recently started accruing these licensing fees and the penalties, and those go back into our OSEC fund, which then rolls into that general fund back in, and it stays, since we operate primarily in the red, it just goes back into the general fund since that's where we're primarily funded from.
And Chair Przanski and Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, I would like to add, as far as the penalties, one of the items I was brought in for was to also create that or rebuild that structure. So the administrative law judge that we have with us on contract, we've done so far have been more of a civil suspension. It has not been a monetary fee for a violation of a regulatory piece.
Oh, and my last question?
Yes.
Why the emergency clause?
Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, could you clarify emergency clause?
Sometimes I get where you're coming from, because sometimes, surprise, there's an emergency clause on the bill you didn't even ask for, but there is an emergency clause that says the health and safety and all that.
The lieutenant sounds like maybe not know what emergency clause is. It means that if it passes the two chambers and it goes to the governor, if the governor signs it, it goes into effect immediately upon the governor's signature.
Yeah.
Normally, we have a default date in this session. It would not go into effect until January 1st, 2018, but we do have the ability to set a earlier date, and we could, in fact, have another modification in saying, like, after 91 days. The reason for the impact of emergency clause is that it stops a citizenry from having what's known as a referendum. Mm-hmm. So if the citizens chose to say, we don't like what the legislature just passed and the governor just signed, with the emergency clause, it prohibits them from being able to go out in a 90-day period and gather signatures. We previously used to have a date of 91st day is when a bill would go into effect. We uniformed it to the following January 1, and now we see on some frequency that emergency clauses are attached to bills.
Some frequency.
Some frequency.
Well, and Mr. Chair.
By both individuals of different parties.
Well, Mr. Chair, I doubt somebody would really want to gather signatures, right. But my point is, it's called an emergency, and that kind of messes with people's heads, and we need to change the name of that.
Yeah, I mean, the question here is, from my perspective, is that we know the state's losing money as it stands right now. Do we want to continue to foster that for until either the default date, or do we want to have an earlier date, but maybe not upon signature? So that's something that can be discussed. And Whitney, you have something that you've been trying to
thank
share with
you.
Us. We'll go to our lifeline now.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Just to follow up on that a little bit, there is the emergency clause for the effective date, but then there's a portion you'll see on the back of the bill that it becomes operative January 1st, 2018. I believe that's for rulemaking
it
time.
It is. So here's the situation. I had not looked at the bill. The emergency clause is basically to give the agency the ability to start immediately doing the work that's necessary to have the bill go into effect. And so basically with this bill, the operative date would be the default date, January 1, 2018, but we need to give authorization to the agency to do the work they need to do to be geared up for that date. And so the emergency will say certain sections of the bill go into effect immediately upon signature, and that is basically the authorization for this pre-work that needs to be done before they actually start the implementation of it. So
I had a question with regard to the funding stream. It's general fund money. We're losing $1 million plus a year, as you described, in the 6% gross tax receipts. That money's a sales tax, essentially, and so doesn't actually come back to OSAC if I've got this broken out right. That would come back through the general fund and fund your operation. It's a math game. I give you $100, and later in the week you give me $100 through the general fund. the 6% of $1 million gross sales would be $60,000. So you're putting a cap right there. Just under $1 million gross sales would be what you cap. Anything that was a $2 million gross sales, we wouldn't gain revenue from any of those sources. Can you tell me how many or what the total sales tax generated through this enterprise looked like on an annual basis? You gave us your net loss number, but what we have a disconnect with is how much money are we actually generating for Oregon through the sales tax side?
Chair Bozanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, and Senator Linthicum, I don't have the exact number for you today as far as for a historical figure. What we did in 2016 was we brought in roughly the 6% was right around $230,000 when you added all of the events. That would be the entertainment wrestling, the boxing, and the MMA events.
Okay.
So but I will get you historical data on that.
That's fine. Not a lot. The 50,000 cap, I was expecting we were really taxing those guys, and the cap was going to create an attractive, but they're not coming because there is no cap. Thanks for the clarification. I'm fine.
Okay. Any other questions? So we have a couple other things we would like to get done, but I think I just need to put on the record, just make sure I understand. Regarding the financial incentive, the cap on the gross receipts, the $50,000 is the amount that would be gross receipts for the particular event. So event A that's in Portland right now, are we saying that our 6% is going to be up to $50,000, or are we saying that we're just going to have a limitation of how much they can bring in through the door of $50,000?
Chair Bozanski, members of the committee, that would be $50,000 for the 6% gross. Okay. It would not. They could bring in unlimited amount inside that door, depending on how many seats were filled.
Okay.
But it would be instead of, for instance, the UFC fight from October 1st was roughly $30,600 that was brought in with that 6%. But we would cap it. Let's say the Moda Center was full, it would be capped at $50,000.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. Then the last thing is, I think, just to kind of put on the record, knowing that cities have the right to have some types of charges or fees. It sounds like Portland has gone with a 6% also gross receipts type of tax.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, that is correct.
And then other cities within the state have something different or none? I mean, depending on where they're at?
Chair Brzezinski, we have not had any major events in the other one, so we have not dealt with them.
So this could be economic development. We just have to have the facility to get enough people in.
All right.
All right. Thank you all very much. Is there anyone else, again, who'd like to give testimony today on Senate Bill 76? Not seeing, we're going to close the public hearing. And if everyone's comfortable, I'd like to go ahead. We have the paperwork to move 76. So I'll entertain a motion on, we'll open a work session for Senate Bill 76.
Okay. Mr. Chair, move Senate Bill 76 to the floor. I don't have it in front of me. So yeah. It is to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 76 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any additional discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I still have some unanswered questions, so I'm going to say no for now, and I might get those satisfactorily answered and change my vote on the floor.
Okay, I think everyone just heard that they will be paying you a visit to see however they can help.
I know. Descend upon my office. Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone else, any other discussion? If not, is there any objection except for the one that Senator Thatcher has put on as a conditional no at this point? All right, with that, the motion carries. And the chair is looking for a carrier. Who would like to be our ultimate fighter on the floor? Senator Manning, looks like you're there.
I do. I think it's assault and battery myself, but, you know.
Well, you can express yourself.
In those terms.
All right, so now we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 76. We're opening up work sessions. We have a few minutes for Senate Bill 5.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 5 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 5 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Any objection? So ordered. We'll put Senator Courtney as the carrier of this bill. If he is not so inclined to do so, Chair will back up if Senator Courtney is not our carrier. We'll close the work session on SB 5. Open a work session on SB 14.
Mr. Chair, move Senate Bill 14 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher now moves Senate Bill 14 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Thatcher, will you be the carrier of SB 14?
Sure.
We'll close the work session on 14. Open a work session on Senate Bill 15.
Mr. Chair, move Senate Bill 15 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 15 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Again, any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And let's see. Senator Dimbrough, would you be our carrier on Senate Bill 15?
Sure.
And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 15. That concludes our work for today. We are scheduled to...
There's on the other side.
Whoops. Oh, ooh. Whoa. Okay. Senate Bill 82. I hadn't turned the page over. I was wondering why Joe was in the office here. All right. So on this one, Senate Bill 82.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 82 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 82 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And I see Senator Manning, you'd prefer to carry this one, I remember?
Yes.
So Senator Manning will be the carrier on 82. Close the work session on 82. Open the work session on Senate Bill 184.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 184 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 184 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So order, Senator Lipscomb, will be our carrier on 184. Thank you very much. So I think now that concludes our work. Everyone, thank you very much. We're scheduled to be here tomorrow at 8:15. Eight. Just eight. Okay. For whatever reason, they snuck in an extra 15 minutes, so we'll see you tomorrow at 8. We're adjourned. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
All right.
We're adjourned. Thank you.